Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is August 5th, 2024. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern. If you're listening over Rumble or YouTube or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find the banners on the right side of a website of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on a donation tab on the top right side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we're going to go into the book of Psalms. Psalms 22. This is a prayer Christ to the Father on the cross, read by Alexander Scorby.
Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and am not silent. But thou art holy, O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in thee, they trusted, and thou didst deliver them. They cried unto thee, and were delivered. They trusted in thee, and were not confounded. But I am a worm, and no man, a reproach of men, and despised of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, He trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. Thou didst make me hope when I was upon my mother's breasts. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God from my mother's belly. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have compassed me, strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round. They gaped upon me with their mouths, as a ravening and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted in the midst of my bowels. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. And my tongue cleaveth to my jaws, and thou hast brought me into the dust of death. For dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me, they pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones, they look and stare upon me. They part my garments among them, and cast lots upon my vesture. But be not thou far from me, O Lord. O my strength, haste thee to help me. Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, for thou hast heard me from the horns of the unicorns. I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation will I praise thee. Ye that fear the Lord, praise him. All ye the seed of Jacob, glorify him, and fear him, all ye the seed of Israel. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, neither hath he hid his face from him, but when he cried unto him, he heard. My praise shall be of thee in the great congregation. I will pay my vows before them that fear him. The meek shall eat and be satisfied. They shall praise the Lord that seek him. Your heart shall live forever. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord, and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before thee. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon earth shall eat and worship. All they that go down to the dust shall bow before him. And none can keep alive his own soul. A seed shall serve him. It shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. They shall come and shall declare his righteousness unto a people that shall be born, that he hath done this.
Okay, Jan, do we have any questions or announcements tonight?
Yes, we do, John. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The first one is, I'm not finding this quote that John has in his file on demand. It says, clerk cannot charge a fee as per the United States Supreme Court. Living as we do under a common government charged with the great concerns of the whole Union, every citizen of the United States from the most remote states or territories is entitled to free access not only to the principal departments established at Washington, but also to its judicial tribunals and public offices in every state in the Union. Crandall versus Nevada, 73 U.S. 35 in 1867. Maybe the case is misquoted.
Well, I'm not too sure. I'd have to look into that. I am working on that particular memorandum concerning, because we did write a memorandum a while back. So maybe next week I'll be able to find exactly where that is. But that's not the only thing. Common law in itself doesn't permit justice. Justice needs to be free. And common sense tells us common sense is common law. Ultimately, maxims are built upon common sense. Things that just cannot be denied. One most obvious one is, for instance, your water cannot run up a hill unless you put a pump on it, of course. So anyway, there is quite a bit, but I'll look into it. That Crandall case does sound familiar. That might be the quote. But again, I'll have to look into it. So we'll see maybe next week I'll make a note. Anything else, Jan?
Yes. If someone is stopped for speeding, can they be arrested for exercising their right to not provide anything that could be used against them in court, like driver's licenses, registration, insurance?
Well, I don't see a problem with producing it, of course. Generally speaking, I can't think of a reason off the top of my head that an officer should be able to stop you. Of course, if you're reckless driving, you'd have a duty to stop you, at least to slow you down, and whatever the case may be. But traffic violations are codes, the statutes, they have nothing to do with us. They cannot be applied upon us. It doesn't apply to us at all. But again, you're only asking for trouble if you're going to be resistant to the cop, because they're totally ignorant to the law. They understand nothing but the codes that they've been told to apply. And I'm sure they share stories of different situations, cops stopping other people, talking to other cops, so on and so forth. And there's a lot of things going on there, I'm sure. But the bottom line is, why give them a hard time? Who wants to see some ID? I don't have too much of a problem with them. I don't give them a hard time, and I'll show them the ID. Insurance is rarely asked for, because generally that shows up on your vehicle anyway, automatically on your computer. And registration, pretty much the same thing. Again, if they give you a ticket, then you deal with that. Your fight is in the court, not with the cop. And again, you're only going to get yourself in trouble giving them a hard time. I don't see why anybody would want to do that. We have a friend, an individual, who listens in quite often and known him for quite a few years, and he did exactly that. And he got beat up there by a couple of cops right there on the streets, and they beat him up pretty bad. And they said, of course, what was the charge? And they said, resisting arrest. That shows you really the mentality, because arrest for what? Couldn't answer that question. So that case, of course, never went anywhere. And he didn't sue. I would have sued. I don't know why he didn't sue. But in any event, next question. Jan, you're muted if you're talking, I think. Let's see.
Either that or I was talking very low.
Okay.
I've sent two parties that I was previously in litigation with petitions, demand for damages and injunction.
Start that over. I missed the beginning. Try it again.
Okay. Can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Here we go. I've sent, and this is going to be long. I know it's going to be tedious to listen through it. I've sent two parties that I was previously in litigation with petitions, demand for damages and injunction, cease and desist notice, all of which went unanswered. I did this myself without the court, because the court was involved, the two parties, and myself disagreement over an inferior contract. The judge enforced the contract without due process, denied a jury trial. I was also denied evidence and a request for extreme hardship to appear via Zoom. I served by right constitutionally allowed notices to the two parties that took me to court, but under duress was forced to sign an agreement to settle in court, thus having the two parties who stole my property through the new agreement I was forced to sign. I served the two parties' notices and sent all notices to the court clerk as well. The court clerk notices all went unanswered. I now want these civil or criminal default warrants served to the two parties. The sheriff's office can't or won't serve the default warrants without an order from the bench or court. I need assistance from a constitutional sheriff that will enforce the warrants. I live in Reading, Mass., Middlesex County. My question is, can you help with the sheriff that will enforce the default warrants or advise what other option I may have?
Yeah, there's really only one option. Again, I don't know enough of the case, and I don't know the specifics. I don't know what exactly you've written. Sounds like there's been a lot of, interchange. And so I really can't comment too much on that. You can't get a sheriff from another county to come in to do the business of another sheriff in the another county. They're restricted to their own jurisdiction, which is their county. Of course, if they're in pursuit or something like that, they can enter into another county. Usually they make the knowledge of that to the other sheriff's department that that's happening and so on and so forth. And usually, of course, they always, comply with each other's requests from county to county. But you can't take a sheriff from one county to come in and do the job of the sheriff in that other county. It's not his jurisdiction. Although there was one state in my research that I found, I forget what state it is, it does show up in the paperwork that we've written on the sheriffs, which we're going to look a little bit at tonight. We did look at that before, but we're going to look at one of the memorandums. But there is a state that gave the authority of the sheriff to act in any of the other jurisdictions within the county. But nevertheless, even with that, it's just process, normal process, and the right thing to do is to notify the sheriff of another county, hey, I'm heading over to do this, that, or the other thing. Really, look at the courts are corrupt. The sheriffs are ignorant. They have no knowledge. Occasionally you get a sheriff that has some knowledge, and very rarely you get a sheriff that has a lot of knowledge. But that's our fault, because we're not doing anything about it. Some of us are, and we all should be doing something about it. And that's why people should get involved in our campaign for constitutional sheriffs, which is under sheriffs here, and click on campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Let's get our sheriffs educated, because without an educated sheriff, you're going to have a lawless county. And at some point in time, there's got to be a requirement. And one of the things we're trying to do with our paperwork that we'll be filing, I don't know exactly when, it's not ready yet, but it'll probably be ready within the next 3 or 4 weeks, and it'll sit and ready for the right timing. And the right timing, we'll discuss that another time. But again, one of the requirements I think we have to require is not just the return of our courts of justice. They have to open up the doors of justice again and get rid of this civil law and bring in the law of the land, which is in the Constitution very clearly. But we also have to educate, make sure we educate the people as they come in to sit as a jurist, whether it's a petit jury or a grand jury. And we also have to educate and require our sheriffs to have a proper education. That's an absolute, without which they're worthless. They're totally worthless if they don't have a proper education. But it does begin with us. It begins with the campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Getting your sheriff a copy of the book. And if you don't have a committee of safety going yet, you can still do it and even meet with the sheriff and talk with them and whatever the case may be. But we do have a process when a committee of safety is developed within a particular county. There is a process to work through to draw that sheriff in and get him educated, get him you know, responding and participating with the people. That's the whole plan. Because it's up to the people to have government by consent. And government by consent also has a lot to do with making sure that our sheriffs are educated. So that's where we're at with that. So what we do have, though, you know, again, you're just not going to get anywhere. I just had a success recently. I think I spoke about it a little bit. It was a traffic violation. I took it into the Supreme Court here in New York. And I knew they couldn't answer it. And I think they were kind of stuck in having to answer it or just remain silent. They chose to remain silent, so they defaulted. And I just filed my default papers. And by the way, you know, if you're going to move your case into the state court, here we call the state court in New York, Supreme Court of Dutchess County, you know, Supreme Court of Orange County, whatever other county you got. And, of course, there's the appellate process. But if you're going to, you know, kind of do this, you want to make sure your wherefore clause is right. And basically that you want them to give you back, of course, whatever the costs are. In my studies recently on writing my papers, and you know, which I've already written before, but I explored it a little more, and I found some statutes that allow you to go for $200, okay, just because you filed papers, $200 plus the cost of filing. In my case, it was $210. So I'll be getting $410 that they have to pay me now, the judge, the prosecutor, and the clerk, because they acted together. So they'll be paying me $410. Now, my investment, or what it cost me, was actually $210. Here in New York, there's a double process. One is $210 to get the what's called the index number to be able to file. And then what's called an RJI, which is $95 for a total of $305. But I never paid a whole thing. I don't just get the index number because I'm looking for the conversation. If they want to bring it a judge in, they're going to have to go and pay the $95. They didn't do it in this case, and they defaulted, and that was that. And maybe next week I'll talk a little bit about that and show some of the paperwork I got. And if I have to update maybe some paperwork on our page under the education starts here and going to law, then I'll do that. But anyway, the only, you know, it's hard to get really any kind of justice in the courts, especially when you're going up against the status quo. And that case is going up against the status quo, just like this traffic ticket was going up against the status quo. They don't like to lose. What the other thing you could do, if you go under today's issues, you can click on Stuck in an Abusive Court, and you can file an affidavit concerning your case, follow the instructions here, and apply it to our case. So we'll be sending a huge amount of paperwork besides our you know, final filing. But we're going to file a lot of habeas, you know, a lot of affidavits, and we've put in over 100 habeas corpuses, which need to be dealt with because they've ignored them all. We've done a lot of non-judicial foreclosures, which they just disappeared or you know, never made it into the file, or whatever it is that they do with it. We do believe all of our paperwork is still up in the Northern District, and they're just really hiding it is what they're doing. They're concealing it, all of which is against the law. But they got the guns. They control everything. So it's difficult to get anything done in the courts. But you can get a win occasionally, and I don't want to discourage anyone from doing their case, but at some point in time when you lose, you can file an affidavit and follow the instructions here on this page. And, you know, and then you can get justice at the end of the day. But that's not going to be until after devolution. That's when it's going to play out. We have to figure out the timing of when we want to file this final paper. And hopefully I'll get it done in the next couple of weeks. And we'll start looking at that paper, you know, sort of taking piece by piece, dissecting it. And looking at exactly what it is, what we're looking for the courts to do to bring us back to courts of justice. And I think there was 22 or 23 points, things that have to happen in the court. And hopefully we'll start talking about that soon. Okay, next, any other questions?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
This is a continuation of the previous question. The two parties have stated in writing that the court has accepted contempt of court and will serve me, probably place me under arrest when I'm served. I'm the sole caregiver to my severely mentally and physically disabled sister, who is nonverbal and cannot be left alone if I am placed under arrest. Is there anything I can do?
Well, in a situation like that, you got to be real careful dealing with the courts and the things that we're doing, because there's something like that could happen. I don't know the story, but generally speaking, usually they fine you, and I don't know the details. So, but again, they can do something with arresting you. I would do an affidavit right away and get that into the courts concerning the problem. But again, I don't really know enough about the situation. Because if anything happens to you, then the care has to be taken. There is a danger there because they may put her into the system and you may not be able to get her back out of the system. So that becomes another danger, another problem. I would find another family member to take care of the situation should you end up in jail for a while. Find somebody or take care of that, prepare for that somehow. You don't want her to end up in the system. All right, next question.
Okay, this is another long one. Recently, after 9 years, I just received a letter 4 days ago stating I have a judgment against me by default for a loan my husband and I borrowed in 2002 or 4 or 5, not sure. Back then, we borrowed $14,000. Fast forward today, they are saying now I owe them $34,994 plus court costs of $238, bringing the grand total to $35,233. This amount is insane. In 2004 or 5, we did pay on this $14,000 loan. After my husband passed, I found myself having a lot of financial difficulties. So much so, I filed for Chapter 13 in 2014 just to stop Interbank from continuously harassing me, along with other financial businesses. Unfortunately, this was only for a short period of time until in 2017, Interbank levied my bank account, which happened to be a joint account at the time with my son. This bank has become a harboring thorn. At any rate, after the levy, I knew I had to go to court to prove this bank was wrong, since all the money they levied at the time belonged to my son. Therefore, it was up to me to prove it, and by the grace of God, I won. The judge ordered them to pay back all monies to my son. Unfortunately, I'm at the crossroads, not knowing exactly what to do. This letter I received is stating their intentions are to garnish my wages, and I should fill out a claim exemption form enclosed in a letter to prove I am applicable to keep some of my monies. I believe I do not owe all this money. Where does the statute of limitations come in? My apologies, by the way, for this extensive email. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions to, that I would have to ask to maybe come up with some thoughts. But generally speaking, let's go back to the son. The son, I presume the son got the money back. And if they didn't get the money back and the judge had ordered it, it's a matter of just taking that order over to the sheriff and making it happen. So that's that one part. And again, I don't know what the status of that is. The second thing is, and really the most important part of this whole thing, is the claim of filing bankruptcy. Now, if you file bankruptcy and you notified these people of that bankruptcy, you should have a copy of that. You're supposed to retain that. And if anybody ever that you filed bankruptcy and gave notice to them that it was done and that they were included in that bankruptcy, if they come out after you to try to chase you for money, you have a good strong case against that particular individual group or whatever the case may be. And they cannot do nothing. They can't take nothing. It's done. It's over with. The only one that seems to beat this is the IRS, and of course that's unlawful also, but that whole system is set up, and all the judges, everybody's frightened of the IRS, and so they get to do whatever it is that they want to do. So again, there's a lot of information, you know, I'd have to know to be able to give even more thoughts or ideas, but those are the two things that jump out at me. $35,000, again, if it was applied in. The other thing is, it does sound like quite a bit of money. That brings us into usury, which is against the law, and again, that's something you go after them for. But you have to really get down to the final details and understand where, you know, how much money you did actually owe, and then at what point, how did it get to the $35,000? They're supposed to give you a breakdown of that, and if they haven't, you need to ask for it. So I guess that's all I can offer at the moment.
Didn't she say she filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy?
Yes, it was 13, not 11.
Well, you need to do 7, I think, to get rid of the debt. 13 is what? Reorganizational, right?
Well, even with that, it stands. Nobody could do nothing until that's dealt with. So that information isn't there anyway either.
Hmm.
And again, I don't know why anybody would file a 13 unless you're a big business and trying to work some things out. But as an individual, you'd want to go for the final bankruptcy and just shut everybody down. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
What if it wasn't a private loan, but it came from a bank? If that's the case, they never loaned her anything. They pulled it out of her trust fund account, and so they didn't. Even if you go back to the original amount, the $14,000, they never loaned her anything. It's made out of thin air. Why would she pay that back? Also, was there a third party involved? Is there a collection agency? If so, and I think Gerard knows how to handle this. It's the third party's debt now. Is that not the case?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions here. We don't have the answers. Are they original individuals? Was it a bank? If it was a bank, it probably just it got a point, half a point, whatever it was on the loan. Was it up against a house, taking a second mortgage? There's so many questions here. I have no idea. And of course, we don't have the time to look into people's different cases, that kind of detail to help. And that's why it's important for people to understand how due process works and understand what they're doing, the strategies, the mindset you need to have, and so on and so forth. And so if you don't have that knowledge, you need to take a course. I mean, we give a course, of course, under Education Starts Here, and you come down to our Court Access in the Common Law course, and you can find out all the information about our course and take our course there. But you have to have a background in how things work, in how the courts work, and there are lots of other things. Every court has a handbook for pro se individuals. They don't like to talk about that, but it's there. It's available because they really want you to get a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to tell you about it. They're not going to offer that up unless you ask. And that's number one. Also, every court, like for instance here in New York, if you go into a New York case, there is a phone number you can call to get a pro se. People, a pro se office, I guess they call it, but a place where pro se people can call, ask questions and different things. But again, you know, they're going to give you information to a certain degree. They're not lawyers for you, but it's really how the process works, how to get the forms and different things of that nature. Federal level is the same way. So all the courts have this. They just kind of hide it and they don't tell you about it. And if you're going to do a case in a particular area, you got to bone up on that case. I had done a couple of years ago, I did a divorce case, and I learned a lot about that, how that system works. And since then, I gave some advice to an individual, spent some time with them, talking with them about their case and some things that they can do and so on and so forth. And in that process, my knowledge, of course, grew greater. So you really want to really bone up on the type of case you have. You have to understand the forms. All the forms are available. Handbooks are available for pro se litigants and so on. But, of course, you got to be careful with all that, too, because they're statutory. But statutory things are one thing, but the other side is the process, the due process. The due process or the process of the court is great. No problems with that. It's the same as it had been 200 years ago. Anyway, people have to think things out a bit. Okay, next.
That's it, John. There are no more.
Okay. All right, I just want to go quickly. We did a paper recently on the county sheriff. We read it, and we did read a paper on sovereignty, which I decided not to put that particular paper in. We were coming in from the standpoint of, I think I didn't put it in, we're coming in from the standpoint of the grand jury, okay? So restoring the sheriff's papers, people have asked and mentioned I put it up online. So it is under the county sheriff here. Just go to sheriff, okay, and just click on sheriff, county sheriff. And you'll come down just a bit on July 31st, 2024, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury filed an action in federal courts to restore the sheriffs, our sheriffs. Click here, read the action. So here is the copy of the action. You can click on that and you can read it. We got from the summons all the way through. And again, the best way to learn law and the best way to learn how to write and particularly write in law is to read papers. And I think we have the best papers because we're focused in on common law. That doesn't make any differences anyway, because you really want to know how they think and how they write, particularly, of course, the decisions. Okay, so just reading the decisions sometimes could get boring, but in between that boring time, you'll get some little diamonds or pearls here and there, and you'll be able to draw out some quotes and make some notes and build a collection of footnotes, as I have done, and all my footnotes are available in our course. I've given them up on the course. So, and people should be adding to them. I still add to my footnotes. Every once in a while, I find something new and add to my footnotes. Reading papers is important. But again, if you read papers, you're going to want to read papers. If you read them from the common law perspective, I really don't know any place else you can read papers from the common law perspective as much as we do than what we've got. So, I mean, we've got lots of cases you can look at. Again, you go over here to the federal court cases. These are all cases you want to read if you're studying law and you want to figure things out. So there's a lot of information here. And then there's court cases that we referred to. Okay, there are some court cases that landmark Supreme Court cases you want to look into. And again, reading them, understanding how justices on the Supreme Court write. And generally, it's pretty good. But again, you know, we've got three morons up there that I don't think I haven't read anything that they've written yet. I'd love to see something that they got to write because they're way out of space there somewhere. We want to spend a little time just looking at a paper that we did on restoring the sheriffs. This is it here. That's the one I just opened. We're done with this. Okay, Memorandum of Law and the Grand Jury Authority. From our perspective, what we're coming into the courts with, this is very important. We're going to be attaching this memorandum to our case, which will be our final papers, which I have been speaking about quite often over the past months. I'm going to be looking through this paper again, to perfect it better. You know, every time I write a paper, I try to look at it many times. I've looked at this many times, but all papers, you know, when you write something and with hindsight, you look back, say, oh, I could have done a little better. I probably could have did this. I should have stuck that in. Maybe I should have said it this way. Looking back and with hindsight and you have a better view. And by looking at this tonight, it's going to give me really some help into appreciating this particular paper that I had written. So let's look at this paper. It's a powerful paper, in my opinion, extremely powerful. And it really gives the people the power and the authority. Everybody should understand this and know this because this should encourage you with power and authority. And we should be very much encouraged with power and authority. You know, we read, I think it was last week or the week before, we read the sovereign that the people are sovereign. I forget what that was called. Let me see. Let me take a quick look at the Monday night. Sovereign authority. So we read that paper last week. It was pretty powerful. If people really sit and meditate on that, read through it again over and over, and start to understand. This is a mindset that you have to have. All important thing. Matter of fact, I think with all the memorandums that we've written, and I think I could say all of them because we're really focused on the main problems here in our court system, but all of them give you a particular mindset, a knowledge, an understanding. And it's a knowledge and understanding, generally speaking, that these judges don't have. They may have a little bit, but they really don't have it. And but let's take a look at this. Let's see. Memorandum of Law, Grand Jury Authority. The purpose, and this was written originally May 11th, 2023. Again, I'm probably going to have to update this, and if I find errors, I usually find them when I speak it out loud. But the purpose of this memorandum of law is to clearly establish the sovereign, unalienable right of the people to have government by consent through the free and independent administration of our own juries. We, the people, have the unbridled right to impanel and preside over our own proceedings unfettered by technical rules and to investigate merely on suspicion. The judiciary, through Congress's bar written laws and the judiciary's bar written rules, have subverted and tainted our juries and hidden our natural law courts of record. It is the grand jury's function to consider criminal charges, whereas prosecutors have no authority to change or negotiate away our findings. Let me make this a little bigger here. Our findings or negotiate a deal with the accused. That would be the prerogative of the petit jury. Grand jury indictments are final and cannot be added to or taken away from without our consent. We, the people, are the author and the source of law. Sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law, for it is the author and source of law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists and acts. And the law is the definition and limitation of power. Sovereignty means that the decree of the sovereign makes the law, and foreign courts cannot condemn influences persuading sovereign to make the decree. The people of this state, as the successors of its former sovereign, are entitled to all the rights which formerly belonged to the king by his prerogative, and the state cannot diminish the rights of the people. Supreme sovereignty is in the people, and no authority can, or any pretense whatsoever, be exercised over the citizen of this state, but such as shall be derived from the granted by the people of this state. We, the people, have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary ourselves, entrusted via natural law to dispense justice. We, the people, ordained and established the Constitution for the United States of America. We, the people, vested Congress with statute-making powers. We, the people, defined and limited Congress's powers of lawmaking. We, the people, ordained limited lawmaking powers via the Constitution. We, the people, did not vest the judiciary with lawmaking powers. We, the people, in all courts of law, are free and independent jurists, independent from the judiciary. The constitutions of most of our states assert that all power is inherent in the people, that they may exercise it by themselves in all cases in which they think themselves competent, as in electing their functionaries, executive and legislative, and deciding by a jury of themselves both fact and law in all judiciary cases in which any fact is involved. And by the way, you see all these footnotes in here. These are a lot of quotes. We, the people, have the unbridled right to impanel our own grand juries. In the U.S. Supreme Court case of United States v. Williams, Justice Anton Scalia, writing for the majority, confirmed that the American grand jury is neither part of the judicial, executive, nor legislative branches of government, but instead belongs to the people. It is, in effect, a fourth branch of government, governed and administered to directly by and on behalf of the American people, and its authority emanates from the Bill of Rights. Thus, people have the unbridled right to impanel their own grand juries and present true bills of indictment to a court which is then required to commence a criminal proceeding. Our founding fathers persistently thereby created a buffer that the people may rely upon for justice when public officials, including judges, criminally violate the law. Right of the people to consent. Summoning the grand jury, elected sheriffs or coroners vested by natural law may summon a grand jury, and we the people vested by nature's God may gather ourselves, if liberty calls, as the sureties of peace on behalf of all the people. Of course, that's what we've done here at National Liberty Alliance by creating the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. In 1215 AD, 25 freemen assembled themselves in the name of the sureties of peace, stood up to restore the natural law courts of justice, thereby taking back their island nation, England, that was subverted by a tyrant king. In 1776, 56 unalienable sovereigns assembled themselves in the name of we the people, stood up to restore the natural law courts of justice, thereby taking back their 13 American colonies that were subverted by a tyrant king. Today, herein, more than 11,400 and counting grand jurists assembled themselves from every state in the name of we the people to stand and restore our natural law courts of justice, thereby taking back these 50 United States of America that were subverted by the judiciary. We the people have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the said judiciary ourselves entrusted to dispense justice. Natural law depends that only the people, via free and independent grand juries and petit juries, have the supreme judicial authority to indict or not, to decide the law, to sit as the tribunals in a criminal case, to nullify any statute, to deny any rule, to judge guilt or innocence, and pronounce the remedy or punishment free from judiciary interference. Tribunals are established in 12 unalienable sovereigns, whose decisions are final and cannot be overturned. New York State Constitution, Article 1, Bill of Rights, Subsection 8 states, the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. The United States Supreme Court in Sheckloth versus Bastamante said, the decisions of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal. The decisions of an inferior court are subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly. And that's what we talk about when we talk about suing the court. Generally speaking, you want to go after the individuals running the court because they usually stepped outside their authority and they have no more protection of the law. They sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to an appeal or to an appellate court. Decisions of a court of record may not be appealed. It is binding on all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or a Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgments of a court of record. The judgment of a court of record, whose jurisdiction is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to the inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. And, of course, these are all quotes. Through Amendments 5, 6, and 7, we the people codified the jurisdiction for criminal and sovereign civilian cases to be heard in natural law courts, which provide that 12 witnesses, being peers of the accused, decide the facts, the law, and the remedy, not the judiciary. Grand jury is a constitutional fixture in its own rights. In the United States versus Calandra, quoted in U.S. versus Williams, the United States Supreme Court said, the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts over whose functioning the courts do not preside. The common law of the Fifth Amendment demands the traditional functioning of the grand jury. The grand jury is an institution separate from the courts over whose functioning the courts do not preside. We think it clear that as a general matter, at least, no such supervisory judicial authority exists. Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government, serving as a kind of a buffer or a referee between the government and the people. Although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse and under the judicial auspices, its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. judge's direct involvement in the functioning of the grand jury has generally been confined to the constitutive one of calling the grand jury together and administering their oaths of office. And that's it. By the way, United States versus Williams, we're quoting a lot in this particular paper, and the judge who wrote that up was Anton Scalia. Grand jury investigates merely on suspicion. The United States Supreme Court in U.S. versus Williams went on to say, the grand jury's functional independence from the judicial branch is evident both in the scope of its power to investigate criminal wrongdoings and in the manner in which the power is exercised. Unlike a court whose jurisdiction is predicated upon a specific case or controversy, the grand jury can investigate merely on suspicion that the law is being violated, or even because it just wants insurance that it is not. It need not identify the offender it suspects or even the precise nature of the offense it is investigating. The grand jury requires no authorization from its constituting court to initiate an investigation, nor does the prosecutor require leave of court to seek a grand jury indictment. And in its day-to-day functioning, the grand jury generally operates without the interference of the presiding judge. It swears in its own witnesses. It deliberates in total secrecy. We have insisted that the grand jury remain free to pursue its investigations unhindered by external influences or supervision, so long as it does not trench upon the legitimate right of any witness called before it. Recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either prosecuting attorney or judge. Right to counsel does not attach before a grand jury. No doubt, in view of the grand jury's proceedings status as others than a constituent element of the criminal prosecution, we have said that certain constitutional protections afforded defendants in criminal proceedings have no application before that body. The double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment does not bar a grand jury from returning an indictment when a prior grand jury has refused to do so. We have twice suggested, though not held, that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel does not attach when an individual is summoned to appear before a grand jury, even if he is the subject of the investigation. And although the grand jury may not force a witness to answer questions in violation of the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee against self-incrimination, our cases suggest that an indictment obtained through the use of evidence previously obtained in violation of the privilege against its self-incrimination is nevertheless valid. Grand jury is unfettered by technical rules. Given the grand jury's operational separateness from the constituting court, it should come as to no surprise that we have been reluctant to invoke the judicial supervisory power as a basis for presiding modes of grand jury procedure. Over the years, we have received many requests to exercise supervision over the grand jury's evidence-taking process, but we have refused them all, including some more appealing than the one presented today. In Calandria versus the United States Supra, a grand jury witness faced questions that were allegedly based upon physical evidence the government had obtained through a violation of the Fourth Amendment. We rejected the proposal that the exclusionary rule be extended to the grand jury's proceeding because of the potential injury of the historic role and functions of the grand jury. We declined to enforce the hearsay rule in the grand jury proceedings, since that would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury institution, in which laymen conduct their inquiries unfettered by technical rules. Grand juries preside over their own proceedings. These authorities suggest that any power federal courts may have to fashion on their initiative rules of grand jury procedure is a very limited one, not remotely compatible to the power they maintain over their own proceedings. It certainly would not permit judicial reshaping of the grand jury institution, substantially altering the traditional relationships between the prosecutor, the constituting court, and the grand jury itself. Supervisory power may not be applied to permit defendants to invoke third parties' Fourth Amendment rights. See generally Beal, reconsidering supervisory power in court cases. Constitutional and statutory limits on authority of the federal courts as we proceed to discuss, that would be the consequence of the proposed rule here. Grand jury's function is to consider criminal charges. It is axiomatic that the grand jury sit not to determine guilt or innocence, but to assess whether there is adequate basis for bringing a criminal charge. That has always been so. And to make the assessment, it has always been through sufficient to hear only the prosecutor's side. As Blackstone described the prevailing practice in the 18th century England, the grand jury was only to hear evidence on behalf of the prosecution for the finding of its indictment. It is only in the nature of the inquiry or accusation which is afterwards to be tried and determined. So also in the United States, according to the description of the early American courts, 3 years before the Fifth Amendment was ratified, it is the grand jury's function not to inquire upon what foundation the charges may be denied, or otherwise to try the suspect's defense, but only to examine upon what foundation the charge is made by the prosecutor. As a consequence, neither in this country nor in England has the suspect under investigation by the grand jury ever been thought to have a right to testify or to have exculpatory evidence presented. Grand jury indictments are final. No case has been cited, nor have we been able to find any furnishings and authority for looking into the revising of the judgment of the grand jury upon the evidence for the purpose of determining whether or not the finding was founded upon sufficient proof or whether there was a deficiency in respect to any part of the complaint. We accepted Justice Nelson's description, where we held that it would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury institution to permit an indictment to be challenged on the grounds that there was incompetent or inadequate evidence before the grand jury. And we reaffirmed this principle recently in Bank of Nova Scotia, where we held that the mere fact that evidence itself is unreliable is not sufficient to require a dismissal of the indictment, and that a challenge to the reliability or competence of the evidence presented to the grand jury will not be heard. It would make little sense, we think, to abstain from reviewing the evidentiary support for the grand jury's judgment while scrutinizing the sufficiency of the prosecutor's presentation. A complaint about the quality or adequacy of the evidence can always be recast as a complaint that the prosecutor's presentation was incomplete or misleading. Our words in Costello bear repeating. Review of facially valid indictments on such grounds would run counter to the whole history of the grand jury institution, and neither justice nor the concept of a fair trial requires it. How the United States Common Law Grand Jury was formed. We the people visited about 3,000 counties to introduce people to the authority of the Common Law Grand Jury with a plan to save our natural law republic. All 50 states organized unified state common law grand juries, after which all unified states common law grand juries came together to form the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. To date, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury is comprised of more than 11,400 people and growing from every state of our union. The Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury has been in session since 2015 with the sole purpose to restore our courts to courts of justice, and will remain in session until we accomplish that mission. Conclusion. The people are sovereign and have an unalienable right to have government by consent through free and independent administrations of our own juries. The grand jury is a constitutional fixture in its own right. The judiciary through Congress's bar written laws and the judiciary's bar written rules have subverted and tainted our juries and hidden our natural law courts of record, and we intend on restoring them. It is the grand jury's function to consider criminal charges, whereas prosecutors have no authority to charge, discharge, or negotiate away our findings. Grand jury indictments are final. It cannot be added to or taken away from without their consent. We the people are the author and source of law and have the unbridled right to impanel our own grand juries, investigate merely on suspicion, proceed unfettered by technical rules, and preside over our own proceedings. Okay, so I'm going to probably make very, very minor changes to this paper, but this is a paper that will be attached to our next paper that we'll be filing, which we intend on being the last paper, and it needs to be filed at the proper time. We don't know exactly what that proper timing is, but I do believe we'll recognize that proper timing when it comes. Okay, with that, we're going to go to an open forum. So let me open up, let's see. Probably should have set that open a little earlier. Anyway, anybody got a question or comment or anything, any corrections to offer? Queue is open. Just get into the queue. It's a *6-1 if you're coming in on a phone. If you're coming in on your app or a way to get into the browser, you should see a button there to get into the queue. Okay, we'll take our first individual who's got a question. Let's see. It looks like Jeff from Pennsylvania. You got the mic. You've been unmuted, I think. Go right ahead. Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, you speak to me, Jim?
You, Jeff? Is this Jeff from Pennsylvania?
No, this is Walt.
Oh, okay. Well, it says Jeff. Are you a 724 number?
No.
Okay. You could take the mic. I don't know why Jeff didn't open up. We'll get him next. But go ahead, Walt.
All right. There's echoing here, but it's okay now. It's better now. Okay. I'll try to explain this without – it's a little bit difficult. I'm in Florida right now, Jacksonville. I'm not domiciled.
Hold on. Is this going to be on a case?
No case.
It's not a court case you're going to discuss?
No.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Let me just make that note. We had a meeting recently, national leaders here for National Liberty Alliance, and one of the things that we did to come up to discussion and discuss that if anybody brings a case up, we really can't spend too much more than maybe 5 minutes on a particular case. It's extremely important that people have a basic understanding of how things work. And if they don't have that basic understanding, then a lot of things that we might suggest to them to do, they may not understand or see how to do it. And that's why it's important to take our course or some other course somewhere else where you come to an understanding of that. But I know with you, Walt, you're saying this isn't about a case, but I wanted to make that announcement. But go right ahead, Walt.
All right. I am not a domiciled person here in Florida. I still have my 585 New York State phone number. I still have my New York State driver's license, but I'm just here temporary as a resident and planning on moving back to Western New York. Now, here's a funny situation that happened, John. On July 1st of this year, I took my classic car Mustang that I did get registered in Florida here just so I could drive around without getting in trouble. And I had to take it to a repair shop 5 miles from here, not to get repaired, just to change the valve springs in the motor because the motor was dropping off at 5,500. We were going to test it at the track. It's supposed to go to 6,000. So the owner of the place and the mechanic says, okay, we'll change the valve springs and that's it. So what they did was, I agree, but I never got any paperwork, like the invoice or the worksheet or nothing. I got nothing from them, John. But here's what happens. 8 days later, he calls me up, the owner of the place. It's a towing company, but they also they restore cars, repair, all kinds of stuff they do there. It's one of the biggest in Jacksonville. He starts giving me these measurements that we're going to have. He took off one valve spring for the intake and one valve spring for the exhaust valve on MRS a V8, 94 Mustang. So he says, here, we're going to give you these measurements, and you can go check to see what you got to get to change the valve springs to give you more pressure so you get more RPMs out of your motor. He's going to let me go do it. So he gives me these figures, and I look at it after he hangs up, and I said, it's all wrong what he's doing. He's way off. There's something wrong here. So 3 days later, I went down to a shop, and I'm waiting with this in the secretary's office there, and he finally calls me into his office. He came back, and this black guy is walking behind me, another customer. He walked with me right into his name is Troy, the owner of this place, and he's standing right next to me. And I said, Troy, I says, look, the information you gave me is wrong. We can't go forward and change the valve springs on this more. We got to check this out right over there. And he starts arguing with me like I don't know nothing, but I know what's going on. So I said, look, Troy, I'll even let you hear the recording I took. It was about a 1.5 minute recording. I took all the measurements, so I won't make a mistake. And he says, I'm in a hurry. So I had to record it. So here's what he does, John. It's going to cause this whole problem now where my car is still there 33 days, and they're hiding my car from me. Here's what happened. He started very, very angry with the mechanic there and that black guy standing right next to me, listening to my business. This guy, I don't even know who he is. He says, you recorded my conversation, and that's against Florida state law. It's a two-party place. And I responded, I said, Troy, I says, I wasn't doing this to hurt you, sir. I didn't want to make a mistake. I had to get those measurements, thousands of an inch measurements you were giving me. He says, well, you should have had someone else do it. So then here's what I did, John. We use the scriptures, and you're going to see what the Almighty brought out of him to show he's guilty, not me. He was spinning me around like a crocodile or alligator with his prey in the water. I didn't know what to do, John, how to answer this, because I wasn't trying to do anything wrong to this fella. And you have to remember, I'm from New York State. I'm not domiciled there. New York State's a one-party system, and I forgot anyway. So I didn't realize about this two-party system in Florida. So here's what happens. I prayed to the Almighty. Says, oh, Father, what am I going to do with this guy? He's screaming at me right here. So all I said, John, was, to this guy, Troy, everything's going to be all right, Troy. And here's what he said, showing he's the guilty party, what I tell you what's going to happen next. He says, yeah, everything's going to be all right for you, but not for me. Didn't realize what that meant right there, but he's admitting he did something wrong, and he did, John. Here's what happens. So I went back every week renting a cab to go back there, try different springs, try different shims, to get those two springs right so we can just finish the job. And they kept telling me, Walt, we got to take off your cylinder heads, the machine those places so we get the springs on right. I said, no, Ford does not do that. And they said, I cannot machine the cylinder heads because the rules don't allow it. You have to just use what the factory gives you. They kept trying to get me to do it. So here's why they're doing that, John, where they committed a lawful act against me. What it is, on a 94 car, on a newer cars with fuel injection, you have to take the manifold off the top first before you can take the valve covers off, because it goes from side to side. It covers up everything. It's not like an old-fashioned carburetor where you can take everything apart easy. So here's what happened. When they took off the top of that fuel injection to get to the valve covers, we removed the valve springs. What they didn't probably know was there are 6 bolts holding that manifold down. But the 6th one is hidden under the nameplate on the top of the fuel injection. It's a polished aluminum, says HO50, and they probably didn't take it off. They just took 5 off, and it didn't come off. So they probably thought the gasket was rusted, so they're going to take a pry bar, John, to get this thing off, and they busted the bolt that was hidden. They didn't know. So that they didn't realize it. If they didn't know what to do, they should have called me or called Ford. So here's what happens. So they told me, yes, we broke a bolt, but they didn't tell me which one. So for next 3-4 weeks, they kept saying, well, we got to take those cylinder heads off to do the job. I said, no, you don't. It's right in my Ford shop, man. You just take the valve covers off, and there's a tool, you take them right off. So here, to get down to the last of this thing, John, here's what I'm going to tell you. On July 26th, I go there with a cab. I got new shims. I said, you put these on. Everything's going to be fine, and we can get this job done. And he's right there, the owner and the mechanic. He's okay, well, it's 10:30 in the morning. We'll put them on. I'll call you back in the afternoon, see if it worked, and we can finish the job so you can get your car. They never called back, John, Friday. That was the 26th of July. I called back Monday, left a message for the owner. He does not call me back Monday. I call him Tuesday, no message back. Wednesday, no message back. So I sent a fax Thursday to them telling them what's going on here. So finally, I got some librarian in Rochester, New York. I'm always in touch with those people. They're good. They looked up the laws, the motor vehicle laws in Florida, telling me what my rights are. They're supposed to give me all this paperwork. I never got any paperwork, John, what they're going to do, the agreement, the contract, nothing. So now it's to the point, I don't even know. Then I saw somebody in a restaurant the other day, the senior citizens where I go, and he said, well, you left your car there. It's been there more than a month. And I said, yes. He says, there's a problem in Jacksonville. He says, some of these shops, after the cars are there for more than a month, they just sell them. And he says, so I says, oh, my goodness. So he says, the one guy at one of these shops sold the car of a customer. It was 30 days, and he got fined $150,000 for doing it. So what I'm saying, John, is this. Here's what I want to ask you. I sent another email today to them at that shop. I'm not email, fax. I said, here's even my email. If you don't want to call me, if you're afraid to call me because you're thinking I'm, you know, what I think they won't call me back is they're afraid I'm going to record the calls. So what I'm saying, I said the last part of my fax today, I said, look, if I think there's something wrong, you're not telling me. That's because you said everything's going to be all right for me, but not for you. Because what they're doing, John, is they're hiding. They damaged my motor. They're tying off that manifold. They're not telling me they did it. So what I said at the bottom of this fax today, it says, Romans 13, verses 1 through 7 may be necessary if, let me see, the problem is kept secret. So when I talked to another senior citizen lady that helped me, I told her this whole story, John. She says, well, I'm recommending, because it's been there 30 days, you may have to take the sheriff there to find out if your cars are right and why they're not working on your car. So my question to you, John, is this. And one more thing I have to tell you. This is a miracle. 1964, this has to do with the Air Force. The buddy system I joined in Rochester, the four of us joined the Air Force. Let me see. A U.S. code... 42, section 9601, I've never been discharged for 6 years from the Air Force, John. I'm not lying to you. They hid my papers. What that means is I'm in the Air Force, and I don't have to tell anybody if I'm recording a call anyway, because there's no federal law saying that the federal government has to announce that they're going to record calls. So this, I know it's a crazy situation I'm telling you, but it's all the truth. So do you think I ought to just ambush him with get the sheriff and go down there and say, what's going on? Why don't you give me the paperwork for my car, and why don't you finish the job you said you were going to do? What do you think should be done here?
Well, quite a few things. I don't know if Gerard wants to respond to some of this also, because he's a mechanic, maybe from the mechanical perspective. But from the legal perspective, first of all, recording in New York, you know, most states, I believe, you can record as long as you're part of the conversation. The states that wrote statutes to prevent that from happening, first of all, it's a statute. It doesn't apply to us. It applies to them. That's number one. Number two, also in the Constitution, Article 4, we read in Section 2, the citizens in each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Also, under common law, it just makes common sense that you can record. What do they have to hide? If you were talking about a deal or a situation, you know.
Also, I told them in this fax, Article 6 says any state making any law that's contrary to the supreme law of the land, that's, you know, the Constitution, it's null and void, that state statute. And here's what I told them, John, another way of saying what you just said. The reason they have this two-party in these certain states, it's to protect corporations from liability when a recording would irrefutably be proved they're committing wrongdoing, so they can't allow to be caught. So what that is, it's part of this corporation, and what's running all these corporations, John, if you didn't notice, I'm going to tell you now. You look up, you go to Wex Dictionary, at LII, Legal Information Institute, that's Cornell University, will tell you it's the artificial person runs all the corporations in America, and it runs the United States Corporation, and it's an entity. It has only limited rights and duties of a human, but it's not flesh and blood, John.
Yeah,
it's replaced by Almighty God's Spirit since the bankruptcy in 1938. It's the rulers of darkness running that corporation, and that's who's coming after that. This guy is that way, and he has a flag in his office. I just got to tell you one more thing. A giant flag in his office by his secretary. He's friends with the sheriff, some of them. It's a black and white and yellow flag, and I said, ma'am, what kind of American flag is this? She says, it's part of the sheriff's department. So that there is desecration of the flag. He can't do that. But that's why I'm dealing with these kind of people down here. And, John, I'm telling you right now, I didn't mean no harm against this man. I just had to record that thing because it was dealing in hundreds of thousands of it was like 30,000, 60,000, all those kind of clearances that add up. And if you don't get it right and you put it together, you can blow up your motor. That's why I recorded. I wasn't trying to hurt that fella.
Right. Well, what do you know about the qualifications of that individual and his people who work for him? Are they highly trained?
When I tell you what he does, you won't believe this.
Well,
I haven't been into racing since
I've been... Hold on. Let's finish off with where we got, because it gets more and more, and we've been talking for quite some time. So let me finish on some of the thoughts around here. First of all, you made a major mistake by not getting a written proposal. I'm not sure exactly what the percentage is and of the law, which again will use their law because it does apply to them. But if you make a contract with someone to do a job, an estimate, okay, like a mechanical estimate, okay,
nothing.
That is limited to 10%. In other words, if they have to adjust that, they can only go 10% higher. Now, it's been a long time, so I think it's 10% is what that number is. That's number one. Okay, so the other thing, of course, if they discover something in the process that could not have been seen before going in there and they say, hey, we found out this and that, and the other thing's wrong, well, they have the right to then give you that, but they have to notify you. So let's just put all that to rest. The point is, though, you should have something in writing. And I'm sure next time you're not going to do that, no matter who's doing the work. You know, you want to get something in writing. Recording, again, we've already solved that problem. They can't make a statute to control us. We have a right to record as long as we're part of the conversation. New York does have a statute. You can apply that in. So those statutes apply to them and not to us. Now, the other thing is the individual who mentioned that 30-day situation, there is what's called a lien, a mechanics lien, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, that could be taken and applied onto an item, and they fall away. I know here in New York, I think it's 9 months, and then you have to renew it to maintain that lien. But the lien gives you a lien. It doesn't give you the power or the authority to take the item. They have to go through certain notifications, and again, I don't know what the law is that requiring for them in the commercial activities, what process that they have to go through, and I would imagine from every state is a little different here or there, but we can use just general common sense, which is common law, and the fact that, you know, they have to, you know, apply something here. So the mechanics lien, again, is something that they would have to notify you of. It's not that simple. They still have to record it in the courts. We have to file in the courts, and they have to serve it upon you. And that's what they're doing. That I presume they haven't done that yet. Have you given them much money yet?
I haven't paid them anything. And the last time I know, when they stopped doing the work, they said there's 2.5 hours labor. I said, that's fine. They agreed to do for $125 labor, and I understood the estimate was going to be. I looked, the library showed how much it would cost to change the valve springs. It was 6 hours, but because they're going to do modifications and shimming and stuff, it would be another 2 hours, 8 hours. It was not going to be any problem.
Okay, I told them the bottom line, though, but let's not get too deep into too many things. The bottom line, though, is you've given them some money, I presume.
No, I haven't given them any.
Oh, you haven't
no
given them. But the bill is about what at this point? You know, did they say?
Oh, he told me 2.5 hours, so it's
okay.
$250.
So that's where that is. Okay, there's a couple of things you could do. I mean, I think that these people don't have the ability to do this kind of work. And if I were you, I'd go in there, give them the 2.5 hours, and have it towed out of there to someplace else. That's number one. The other thing, if there's a refusal or a problem with that, they cannot hold your vehicle. Also, in order to go, you know, you're communicating with them over this time period. So the 30-day process that other person was talking about doesn't even exist. But still, there is a process and procedure that has to be followed anyway, whatever that might be. Generally, as filing with the court and serving notice to you that a lien has been put in place. But remember, they still can't take your vehicle. I mean, you're protected under the Fourth Amendment. Okay, the Fourth Amendment protects you from that. And the only way that they can actually seize that vehicle, even though they have a lien on it, the only way they can seize that vehicle is to go to court, get a court order, and have the sheriff come out and make that service. And if that hasn't been done, then, of course, nothing's going to go on there. So you're the one who, really with the upper hand. I would give them their 2 hours' worth of work and pull the vehicle out of there. And it sounds like, well, maybe not even give them the 2 hours, because it sounds like they made some damage to your vehicle, and you have to have that
John, I wanted to say, shouldn't I take a sheriff with me just because they got two real bad dogs in that office?
Yeah, that was my last thing. First of all, what you want to do is write an affidavit of exactly everything you just told me, very specific. But look, don't get too deep into things and too long of storytellings or too technical. Just as general as what people need to understand the thing, you know, the what happened, is you want to keep it simple. You know, less is always more in court. Trust me, less is always more in court. If you could make a statement that has 10 words in it, and you can get that down to 9 or 8, then you need to get it down to 9 or 8, because less is always more. You find a powerful word to use, maybe to help you in whatever you're describing. But the bottom line is this: you get an affidavit, you know, you write it up, you take it down, and you go talk to the sheriff and say, you know, first of all, you want to go there and see if you can work the arrangement out with them. Say, hey, look, you guys don't really know what you're doing. You've caused more problems. On the one hand, you did 2 hours worth of work, but on the other hand, you probably did more damage than the cost of what I owe you. I want to move this vehicle out of here, take it someplace else. If the damage is less than the 2 hours, I'll give you whatever's left over. I mean, that's a righteous way to deal with it. And they're probably, I think they'll let it go, but I think they'll see the problem themselves. And if that doesn't work, and then you just take the vehicle out, say, hey, look, I'm going to call up and have my vehicle towed, and they're going to say, no, you can't. I had that happen to me once, and they locked the gates. You know, my car was behind gates, so I couldn't get to it to take it out. But I did end up giving them a couple hours of pay that I didn't think they deserved and got my vehicle out of there. It just wasn't worth it, and I didn't have law knowledge back then anyway. But the bottom line is this: if they're not going to allow you to have your vehicle, you go to the sheriff with your affidavit, you file a complaint, and ask the sheriff to come over. I want my vehicle back. There's no choice but to go over and get it. And the guy may say what he wants, and the bottom line between him and the sheriff is going to be, you're going to have to take this to court if you think I have a case, but he's got a right to his vehicle. He can take it. Get a tow truck.
John, thank you, but I just want to ask you, could I just do this without going after, I could tell the sheriff, I know a sheriff, he's already come to see me, we already talked about some of this stuff, we're friends, mm-hmm. when I moved here, but what I'm saying is, could I just ask him, his name is Williams, Sheriff Williams, if we just go down there together and just ask him, is he going to finish the job, or could I do that with the sheriff, and as the sheriff as my witness?
No, I think you should do it yourself. Go down there and ask him what his intentions are, find out the bottom line, and then act accordingly. I want my vehicle back. Oh, I want my money. Well, you didn't fix my car, and you damaged my car. I wouldn't get into much more of an argument than that. I have a feeling they're just going to let you take the car because it's less aggravation for them. If they give you a problem, then you go see the sheriff, you go down and take it back. But you do want to do an affidavit, have it filed in a report for going back to seize your vehicle so you have a record of everything that took place.
Mm-hmm.
But no one could take anything from you. The sheriff is the only one that could do that. They could do a mechanics lien. A mechanics lien is just a mechanics lien. It doesn't give them the right to come and take your vehicle. Okay? So they don't have that power.
Can I do that affidavit with a U.S. Code 28, Section 1746, an unnotarized sworn statement?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, but no, everything you do has to be notarized. I mean, you could do whatever you want, but that becomes hearsay. No, you got to swear to it. I do nothing that isn't sworn to. If I do notice and demand, it's going to be notarized.
Okay. All right, John, thank you very much, and it was nice talking to you folks. But are you aware, though, that one thing I was telling you about the artificial person, though?
No, what's that?
Okay. Just go to Cornell University, LII, Legal Information Institute, and look in the WEX dictionary, W-E-X dictionary.
Okay.
What it's going to say is, it's an entity created, but it has limited rights and duties, but it doesn't have inalienable rights or constitutional rights, and it controls all corporations, and
What is this called? Artificial what?
Artificial person. It's AI, and also this, John. It has no flesh and blood, and it's alive.
Yeah, it has no such thing. It's all just...
Oh, it's there. It's. I've already discussed it with people in the government already. I talked to someone in a court in Rochester, New York, and this artificial person, another case of my Social Security, falsely entered into the electronic PACER system, dismissing my case. But when you look on the PACER, who it was that did it, there was no judge or anybody else. It goes back to the artificial person. What that is this. John, just let me tell you real quick. Before 1938, the judge would come out of the back chambers when the bailiff said, all rise. He had the Bible over his head with his right hand. He had the common law, like you said. That was running the Constitution and God's law. That's the spirit that was in the courtroom. We had faith of that. But after the bankruptcy, it was done away with. But there's not a vacuum in the courts today. And you look up the definition of the United States. It's a corporation. So the artificial person runs the corporation, because when you look up the definition for artificial person...
Well, hold on. Look, law is constructive, and that law is being constructed upon something that's already null and void. It all lacks common sense to begin with. There is no such thing as an artificial person. Okay, it doesn't exist. They can do whatever they want on their papers, but in a court of law, there's no power.
What I'm trying to say is, when you go into the court today, they don't even want you to swear to God you're going to court. What God's spirit is allowed in the courtroom is because there's another court in there. It says, Luther's of Americans, Ephesians 6, and that is the artificial person. If you ask the judge that, he will not deny it. Say, who runs this courtroom? Is it the Almighty Yahweh?
Look, we know that these courts are not lawful courts because they run on statutes and they apply it against the people. So these are courts. These are what's called foreign courts. When I speak in a paper about a foreign court, I'm talking about courts right here in the United States. I'm talking about town courts, village courts, most city courts. Matter of fact, all city courts. I'm even talking about the state courts at this point. They're all in the same boat, okay? They're foreign courts because they're operating under civil law, and civil law is Roman law, Babylonian law, Justinian law, it's all municipality law, it's all the same thing. It's statutes built up to control people and enslave us. That's what it's all about. We're under LAW with a capital L. It could be law, in law, at law. All of it,
John, it's not supported by the Spirit of the Almighty, is it?
Well, of course not. That's the bottom line.
Here's the thing. Let me finish with this. Please let me just say one more thing. That spirit is gone in the courtroom. We just agreed on that. But it's not a vacuum in there. There's another spirit in there beside these civil laws and all these laws. It is, if you look it up, you ask the judge, who do you work for, the United States of America or the United States Corporation? And that corporation, he'll say the corporation, what runs the corporation, John, look up again, look up artificial person at the Webster Dictionary. It is an entity, but it doesn't have flesh and blood. It's alive. It's really alive, and it's controlling the corporation. It's right there for us to read it. Just please check it out. I'll talk to you about it down the road.
Okay. All right. Well, basically, the AI and all that stuff ultimately brings us to the Tower of Babel, ultimately.
Yes.
I don't want to get too deep into that, but that's the bottom line. Okay.
Thank you for helping me.
Appreciate it, though. It was a good good story there.
All right. Thank you very much, John, and Gerard, too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Let's see if this button is going to work, because Walt should have popped up. Let me see if we can get that going. Okay, Jeff should have popped up. Jeff, you got the mic right now.
Hi, John.
How you doing, Jeff? Jeff from
PD. Good, John. Hey, I emailed Jen. I hope he received it. I asked him to pass it on to you and Gerard. It was an interview on Rumble under this channel known as the Commoner Law Group. And it was a really very thorough interview, discussed much of the things that resonate with NLA, Common Law, 1871, original 13th, with an exact ratification date. The gentleman that was a guest, his name was Rick Jones. I can't really find too much contact information on him. I tried looking, but that's just another pursuit I can undertake. But I'd ask Jen, I've also provided him with this show with in different formats, MP3 and MP4, and also just a direct website link under Rumble. But I said I felt it was worthy that maybe it could be uploaded on NLA for the members and viewers and visitors of the website, because it discusses things such as, you know, the right to travel, legitimately, you know, rescinding the driver's license, and then also...
We don't teach people to rescind their driver's license. You know, what I do, look, it's never been brought up, but in my mind I'm already prepared. If they were ever to say that I had a driver's license, therefore it means something, that I have to abide by something, my response to them is, look, I wasn't driving under my driver's license. The cop just asked me for my driver's license. I haven't had it. I figured he wanted ID. I got it for two reasons. Number one, I used to drive commercial. I may want to drive again, so I have to have a driver's license. That's number one. And number two, it's a great identification card. So that's it. That's my mindset should they ever bring that up to try to make that argument. It doesn't bring me into their system or their process. So anybody trying to get rid of their driver's license because they think it means a problem, they're really only creating more problems for themselves ultimately, especially if they're going to drive. At least they won't arrest you if you got a driver's license. Give it to the cop. Who cares? I'm not going to argue that point. I'm just not going to pay the ticket. I've made it decision now. I'm never going to pay the ticket ever again. And my last one that I finally decided on, because I file papers in the court, and I think maybe half the time I just never hear back from these people anymore when I file my papers with them. I just put it through the mail. The other half of the time, they do respond. They do give me a hard time. And I just pay the fine because I haven't got time to deal with it. But I did make the decision to take it to court two tickets ago. But they threw it out of court because I told them I'm not giving up on this thing. We're going to court and I'm suing you all. I told the judge that and I told the prosecutor that. And those were the only two people. But anyway, this last ticket I got, this court, they just didn't want to let me go. I mean, they got their teeth in me and they ignored everything, threw everything away. And I said, this is it. So I took them into Supreme Court. I don't want to go too much into this because I already spoke about this. But took them into Supreme Court. They did default. I'm collecting, cost me $200 to do that because that's what it costs for me to put into the court, but I was able to get $400 out of it. So actually 210 plus 200 is 410. So it doesn't cost me nothing to take it from the traffic court into the state court and have it dealt with as a nuisance because that's what it is, a nuisance.
Well, he went on the front of discuss. Except the citation. Don't argue on the street there.
Right. The cop is lost. He has no clue. And you're not going to win that argument. And it doesn't go anywhere. It just gives you more grief and problems.
I
argue with the judge.
Yes.
Politely.
But there were some people that called in, like on this show here, on this call here. And this one gentleman, I can't remember his name, but he, anytime he faces a citation, he just writes refuse for cause, invalid claim, no contract, and he never hears from anybody again.
I don't believe it.
I just thought I'd bring this up because I know a lot of people the last couple of weeks have had traffic ticket problems, and I thought I'd just put in a couple of, 2 cents in there and see if I could just...
Look, Jeff, I don't believe it. I've been doing this long enough, Gerard and I, and we've been in so many courts, and we've listened to so many people teaching. We've heard so many different things, especially when we're on a man on the land stuff, which was the first thing we fell into, which was a trap. Okay, we discovered that's a trap. But in any event, we listen to people talk, and they get all these amazing stories. Look, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. I know what's going on in the courts, and these judges, when they put their teeth in, they don't want to let go. And when you push back, they get angry. Who are these people? I'm the judge. This is my court. You better get your rear end in here. We're gonna deal with this. This is their attitude. Not necessarily they talk like that, but they this is their attitude. Okay. So to write just a few little things like that and to get you out of it, no, I don't buy it. I don't believe it. It might have happened once that they got away with it for some reason. Don't know why. But there's no way that it's going to happen over and over again and going from court. It's just not going to happen. No. So I think what I'm trying to say is this. We have to be careful on who we are listening to learn these things. Look, truth is self-evident. That's a fact. That's a biblical principle. Well, how do you know if it's true? Well, just listen long enough. You're either consistent or not consistent. Okay? It really is that simple. That takes time, though. And you figure it out. So if you listen to someone that's got all these things that's going on, listen long enough, and you'll see whether they're consistent or not consistent.
Yeah, I try to scour and just listen to find a consensus among the different groups, channels, and circles to see where it resonates. There's some common ground. And a lot of things they do discuss do resonate, like I said, with NLA. But and he did, and again, those were callers in. That when they entertain questions, but the host himself was pretty knowledgeable and stuff because he talked about original 13s ratified on March 12, 1819. We know that's accurate. Bought unalienable versus inalienable, and by body sovereign versus the body politic. And he also had the literal definition under the Giles Jacobs dictionary on what common law really is, word for word, which is nice because up on the screen they actually could run through to things like you have your presentations, but even audio is sufficient if you were listening in the car or something. But no, I just thought I'd put it out there if yeah. you want to take a look at it. But just in other well, comments.
There is one other thing that we have to realize also. None of us is perfect. We all make mistakes, and sometimes we do have a little poison in with our stuff. But we have to be ready to make that correction and make those changes when we discover it, and that's key, to admit to the problem, which is no big deal because no one's perfect, you know. I've admitted often to different things, well, I was wrong with that one. And the school of hard knocks, you know, that you got a lot of things going wrong in that when you're going through that process, and you're trying to work it out, you know. So we all work through, you know, hit and miss. We find our errors, we change them, correct them, and move on. You know, I had a conversation with an individual once who had written a book, and the premise of their book was the error. And I knew it would be hard. I exposed that error, but they're not interested in making that correction. They had way too much invested into that. So we have to be careful on the foundation that we build and then construct upon it. And law is constructive. Remember that. That's an important point to remember. Law is constructive. Line upon line, precept upon precept. Just it's the biblical principle. Okay? That's the biblical principle. That's what law is. And common law, of course, is the Bible. It is God's law. It's written in the hearts of men, ultimately, so everybody basically knows right from wrong. It doesn't matter. Even if you don't have a conscience, you still intellectually know what's right and what's wrong. So God already wrote that into our hearts and minds. But go ahead if you want to make some other points.
A couple questions with your case. How do we, as members, join into that case, join onto that case for the judiciary?
Put an affidavit in. You go up to, you go up to the sheriff's page. There's a few places I put it, but the sheriff is probably the best place. No. What am I saying on that? No, that's for the other case. No, you go into today's issues and click on Stuck in an Abusive Court. Well, if you look on the right-hand side, you'll see this judge here, you know, picture of a judge, and you can click on that. It'll bring you to the same place. You're stuck in an abusive court. And just read through that page, and basically I'll just read a couple of things here. It says, natural law requires that for every injury there must be a remedy. If you have been injured by the courts, we, the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, will restore you. Examples of injuries, mortgage foreclosures, tax foreclosures, denial of due process, unlawful imprisonment, denial of habeas corpus, denial of the right to travel, hijacked into a family court, hijacked into a probate court, denial of any unalienable rights. So there's a whole list of things. But the bottom line is not to misunderstand that, because we cannot win right now. We just can't do it. But what we're doing is, because the win is going to come very soon, because something's going to happen. You know, the military at some point is going to move. We use in the military as ultimately as, you know, we copy three, now four different military facilitators or whatever you might want to call that. Okay. But that's our enforcement. And we're under the understanding that the military has used a 2015 filing of a writ quo warranto, which I thought was a pretty powerful paper. And I guess they did too, but that gave them the authority by the people, because they accepted our authority. And so that gave them the authority to use that as a leverage in the court to force certain things, probably on the Supreme Court level, you know. And I think that's probably why we've been getting a lot of different, you know, really good decisions from the United States Supreme Court. You know, Roe versus Wade overturned. Second Amendment reinforced the fact the right of the people will be able to keep and bear arms, and some other cases. So now this information comes from SG Anon, which is pretty good. He did put out a paper recently. He read a paper recently in his last report, and he was talking about quite a few things, which was very interesting. But he did make the point on that particular paper, they were a little bit unsure about something. But he did think that it was a paper that had leverage and authority was being used. But what threw me off at the end of it, which kind of made me set back, is that the person who wrote it put their fingerprint on it. Now, people claim that the fingerprint is a common law process of the signature. That's nothing could be further from the truth. That is not true at all. It doesn't play anywhere. You won't find it anywhere in common law. Where that came from was from Indians, American Indians, and some people ran with that. But then people have spoken and said that this goes back into common law and this is the way to do it. You put your thumbprint on it. Look, I don't want them to have my DNA or my thumbprint to begin with. Okay, so I'm not going to do that to begin with, but it has nothing to do with the law. So anyway, I'm not too sure exactly where I was going with that, but back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, on this topic of SG, I think you're referring to that audio file 78, but that was a pretty lengthy
one. The last one they put out. I think it is 78. So my point is I'd be a little careful with that document. The document was powerful. A lot of it was blackened out, and that was kind of an interesting one, the fact that it was blackened out, so it was redacted by somebody. But what was brought forth was common sense, so it definitely was lawful. But to what credibility or what leverage is being used by the military or what other organization in order to leverage the courts or leverage their position? Again, I don't know, but what bothered me was the fact they signed it with a fingerprint. That just threw me off. It makes me wonder. So, but the document was powerful.
Yeah, I noticed, and it was thorough. I noticed even his general discussion, even from his point of view, but he was also, you know, he captures what he researches, and he just relays them back to the listening audience. But he mentioned a lot of dark things that seemed imminent within 10 days of November 5th, if you picked up on that, too.
Pretty,
even part of the plan, but just, you know, we all don't know. But it just seemed a little bit discouraging or, you know, disenchanting, you know, daunting about just, you know, with the economic.
Well, I will tell you that Q has been very accurate. A lot of people that don't follow or really understand how that whole thing plays out, because what Q had said back in 2019, 2018, that didn't come to play, it didn't come to pass, really, but Q, you know, Q is not an individual, it's military intelligence, and Q actually exists. Q level is the highest level of, you know, top secret available. It's military. And, you know, one of the things they kept saying from time to time, at least on two or three occasions, was future proves past. So even though things didn't happen back then, people were looking for it, it didn't happen, a lot of people fell away, they didn't understand, but they just didn't pick up on that one point. Now, what has been said back then is clear today. Anybody following through? SG Anon does a pretty good job laying it out. Even Dave brings things to point that becomes obvious. What's that other guy's name? He's a military guy, singer. I don't know why I can't think of his name. But in any event, he comes up with a lot of good stuff. He's probably the most knowledgeable of all of them, in my opinion.
Derek Johnson.
Derek Johnson. Okay, yeah, that guy. I think he's the most, he's got the greatest knowledge of what's going on military-wise that I've heard. Anyways,
I'm sure you've heard of. I'm sure you did. Mickey Kwan, with the Bonds. I haven't heard of her in a long time or seen her.
I'm familiar. Well, look at, you know, I don't want to. I don't know much about, but it did seem like she's talking that she has a lot of success. I don't believe that. Maybe she's had one good success. Okay. But lots of success? No, I don't see that. None of us have had lots of success. I don't know anybody's got lots of success. We don't have lots of success. And I think we have some of the most powerful papers. And yet, you know, we don't have lots of success. So it takes a lot to shake these judges' trees and all these people. It really takes a lot. And they have to be somewhat isolated, maybe off in the woods somewhere, so to speak, because, you know, out in the cities and stuff, you know, it's just not going to happen, a lot of this that they're looking. I've been trying to get bonds and oaths from judges and all kinds of people for years now, and I've never got it once.
You know what, John? I probably brought this up before in a past call. I've been trying to get the oath of office and the surety performance bonds from my state representative, and they told me that they're not required to be bonded. I find that hard to believe.
Why? Look at that. That's ignorance and lying. They probably look at if they believe that, it's because they've been lied to and they're just suckers and they believe it. Remember, lawyers believe what they're told to believe. You know, they're told literally, don't use the Constitution, use statutes. It's more accurate. It's specific. You know, there's nothing that needs to be debated there. You know, it's just straightforward. So use that. If you took the jurisdictionary course, that's one of the things that particular lawyer says. And he tried to get into the common law, but he really didn't understand it enough. But he was trying to get over to that position. But he's a lawyer, and he's been schnookered. He believes that we have to apply the statutes and the civil law, and right there is a construction upon a faulty foundation. So everything, you know, he taught due process. That's why I learned due process from that guy. It was the beginning of my learning due process. I mean, I learned a lot more from my research after that, but he was the guy that gave me the beginning to be able to really be able to get into the courts. I was able to see the structure and understand due process to some degree from that course. So it wasn't an invaluable course. It gave me a lot. So.
Well, yeah, I was enrolled in that, but after a while I couldn't justify maintaining $100 a year for something I'd use 2 hours a year.
No. Look at that guy became money greedy, so that's a flaw too. That's another problem. When I took the course, I think it was $300, and I got everything. Got all the PDFs, I downloaded, I got two thick books of everything. That's where I started to work my understanding from all that information, all of that different stuff that he had brought into the course. But I did hear that he moved to what does he charge as the initial? Is it starts off at 100, or is it like 300 and then 100 a year? Or how does he work with that?
$249 and $99 a year after that, you know, consecutively.
How much was the initial?
$249, $250.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably about what I paid, but I didn't pay anything after that. But I got everything, all the goods up front. You see, I mean, immediately. I paid. I got everything. I understand you have to go to his website, and you'll get locked out if you don't. And I don't know if you can download the PDFs. I don't know how it's set up. But that's just, look, everybody tries to make more money on everything, and it just gets sickening after a while, you know, trying to make you join the club and all that other crap.
I kept getting emails, you know, from him, you know, jurisdictionary about recommending friends and stuff, make money, but it was just referral, $50 referral. And I'm not going to convince people that don't even want them there.
I had his link up on the website here, and you know, we would get someone that signed up and went in from time to time. But when I heard that what he was doing with this other thing, we took his link off and went after. I think his course is good for a beginner. To get a good understanding, and my advice is just to be careful. He rests on statutes. We rest on common law. Not that he used that much statutes anyway, but he did teach it, and he didn't make too big a deal. Generally, he was showing the process in the court, which is what we need to know, the due process.
John, there's 14 minutes left, and there's four people in the queue yet.
Okay, we got to move on, Jeff. Appreciate the call.
All right, John. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Dan from South Carolina, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yes, this is Dan Stanlin, and I'm not going to take but a minute or two. My voice is about had it anyway.
I know you're trying to get a hold of us. I know Gerard said he's been trying. He's been busy too. I don't think we're too interested in that. So, but we can't get into that conversation.
I wasn't about to do that. No. Anyway, I'd play my voice if I had it, but I'm wondering, the information that you read over that was paramount tonight, as to from start to finish, will you have it printed up and available, and can we, for a set price, be able to access it, and then we can certainly make an effort to possibly use it in our procedures in court?
Well, look, first of all, we don't sell these kind of things. We give it all for free. I mean, all of our memorandums are available, even though they're in a course. Pretty much everything in a course is available, ultimately, but it's not put together in an instructional way, and that's what the course is about, bringing it together in an instructional way. But, yeah, you can go up to click on Sheriff's right up here in the top blue bar. Just click on Sheriff, come down, and we filed this on July 21st. Click on Restore Sheriff's PDF, and you'll find it in here. Because it is a memorandum attached. This is it here, I think. So when I was filing this paper, we did read Being Sovereign, and I exchanged the sovereign paper with the grand jury paper because this made more sense, because we're coming in as the grand jury and not just the sovereign people. We're coming in as, you know, the United States, Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, and we're sovereign people. We are the lawmakers. So, but it's right here. So that's where you find it. You can download it, use it. I mean, people, look, you can cut and paste things out of this. You know, if you just wanted to use one section, you know, the law is constructive. You construct your case. So you could take anything and cut and paste, and that's how I build my cases, a lot of cut and paste, because I collect a lot of this stuff. I collect decisions. I collect a lot of common law stuff, historical stuff, you know, history, quotes, and everything. The only thing bad about this is if you cut and paste from a PDF, it doesn't carry over the footnotes. If it's in Word, it carries over the footnotes. But, you know, you can then take footnote number 3 and you can copy footnote number 3 and then paste that into your Word when you're putting this together, and put that footnote back in. So that'd be available.
Well, that was certainly quite informative. Array of information that everybody should have for every case to go by.
And again, you know, you can go to Education Starts Here, come down to Law, and then click on Memorandums of Law. Now, these Memorandums of Law, and we even have more than this. I'd like to get them all up here. We got a lot of these in the course. And right now I'm going through all my memorandums, and like I had mentioned earlier tonight, you know, every time you read through something, you find something you could have did better, or you find a little error here or there, maybe something I should have added, and you can add it. So, you know, no matter how much you perfect a paper, it'll never be perfect, you know, but you do the best you can, and it suffices anyway, you know.
What topic, and so I know you got other people there, what topic would you, in a normal case, would you actually use that in an affidavit, or would you use that as meritorious lines of defense? I'm just curious which, and then cite.
It's that particular memorandum was to support our right to be a grand jury. We don't need their permission, and they're refusing us access into the court so we can operate under the auspices of the court. We did try that in the very beginning. We got rejected. We went to numerous courts here in New York State, and each one of them rejected us. And so we couldn't get into the courts to operate under the auspices of the courts. So we're in tents camped outside, and we're not going to allow them to decide on what we can do and what we can't do. We're sovereign. We could do what we want. We, the people, ordained and established the Constitution for them. We are the ones that put forth the law and restricted them and gave them, we vested them with certain powers and so on and so forth. So that's, that. We're the people, we're the power. They don't have the power. They have only the power we've given them, and we've restricted them. They've got a clipped sovereignty. And as long as they're operating within the criteria of what we gave to them to operate in, and they don't step outside and take authority beyond that, they're safe. They can't be, held liable for anything that they could be injured by. But once they step outside of that, we got them. That's it.
Mr. John.
The United States Supreme Court just solidified and repeated that in the Trump case. But go ahead. And we're going to have to move real quickly. So
yes, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to yield. Thank you so much. Super information. Super. I mean, it's awesome. But I do want to yield for the other people. I know how it is. And so that they're wanting to get on there. So I'd like to yield right now.
All right. Thanks, man. We'll take our next person. George, you got the mic. What's your state?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. What state are you from?
I'm in Florida.
Okay. You're a little distant, if you can get a little closer to Mike, but go ahead.
Okay. Is this better?
That's better.
Okay. I was recently driving up through Georgia, and I was in a horrific car accident. A guy came up from beside me, and he crashed into me in a really strange way. He hit me in the front, and then the car spun around, and then the back came around and hit him. And the force of the hit was so violent that the right passenger side front tire came off the rim.
Wow.
The thing of it is, if you look at the damage on the car, there's only two strikes, one in the front and one in the back, and nothing on the side. In other words, he didn't sideswipe my car like he might have been drifting into my lane. No. It really, by the evidence, I'm an engineer, so I look at the evidence, it looks like he took his steering wheel and drove into me like a road rage kind of a thing. And I think what he wanted to do was just scare me, but he must have lost control because he came up so fast.
Road rage is pretty dangerous. I had a friend just recently, about 6 months ago, some individual went crazy, road rage on him. Finally caught up with my friend, cut him off, came out of the car, and put a knife through his heart. Of course, he died.
Oh my God.
That's pretty serious. You've got to be careful. People lose their minds. Is there a question or a point? Because we don't have much time.
Yeah, real quick. What I was wondering, I tried to call the sheriff and file an assault complaint, and they refused. They said you got to hire a lawyer for that. So my question really was, isn't that the sheriff's job to file a criminal complaint?
Absolutely. The sheriff should have taken your application, your affidavit, and maybe his investigation wouldn't come up with being able to bring it to a jury. Maybe it would. But look, sheriffs have no clue what their job is, most of them anyway, unfortunately.
There is a reason.
I'm going to meet my sheriff recently. My sheriff died about a year ago, so good guy, and really was constitutional. But when I go see him, I'm going to bring, even though I gave it to the other sheriff, I don't know if he's got a copy of it, but I got, the handbook that I wrote, County Sheriff's Common Law Handbook. So I'm going to be giving him that, and I'm also going to give him a copy of my book, Government by Consent, see where he goes with that. Hopefully he's going to be as good a sheriff as the other sheriff. I'm hearing that he's pretty good, but not as good as...
I just had one question. What else? Is there anything else I can do on that? I'm not in Georgia.
There's nothing. The insurance covered the problem.
I'm sorry?
The insurance covered the cost of the repairs or replacement of the vehicle?
Oh, I got to replace the vehicle. I'm coming up $10,000 short to replace it, and I'm surprised that it's only three.
Whoa! Obviously, his insurance is paying for it, right?
Right.
refuse the check. Don't sign it. Don't take it. Yeah. Tell them we're going to court. You got to replace that vehicle. You have to replace it with something. Look, at this is a game they've been playing for a while now. It never used to be so, although they did try to get away with it. But when you hold them to the mat, so to speak, they usually fold. The bottom line, you need to get me a vehicle like I've had, roughly the same mileage, same condition, and something I'm happy with.
What about the rental? What about the rental? Now, normally the rental is until I get a repair. But they said that once they declare that the vehicle's totaled, you only get a short time with the rental, and they gave me until Friday.
Again, you need to take them to court.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to walk with what they're giving you.
Okay. No. All right. Thank you. I don't want to take too much. Thank you. Yield.
All right. Okay. Thanks, George. All right. Asula, how you doing? You got the mic. Asula, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. How you all doing?
Good. Yourself?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thank you. I do have a question because I talked to one of our sheriff here. I gave him the book and he said, I asked him how did he like it, and he said he had to backtrack something, so obviously he didn't know much about the Constitution. But he agreed to have a meeting. When we have a meeting, that he can, he can be there. So my question is, what do I need to do to, get the meeting for the people to come so the sheriff can join us?
You got a committee of safety going, right?
Committee of safety, not in here, but it's in a different area from Missouri.
All right. So I'm not understanding your question. You want to meet up with your sheriff, and what? That's where I understand.
Well, what does it take for us to have a meeting? Where we can have the sheriff come out and sit, in the meeting.
First off, if you have some kind of a group, an organization, so on and so forth. I mean, really, the Committee of Safety is what we want, because that's government by consent. The whole thing was set up for that process, and we teach that process. But let's say you belong to another organization, a gun club or something or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, and you got maybe 20 or 30 members, blah, 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 and you want to have him out for some reason. Well, he's looking for constituents that will support him. He shouldn't have any problem talking to you. I would suggest have an original meeting with him. You make a phone call, get an appointment. We'd like to come in and talk to you, a couple of us, and make an appointment, and you go to that appointment, keep it short, tell them you only want 10 minutes or so, and you just want to discuss, the law, really, and his job. And so you go in, you spend 10 minutes, you bring them the books, and you say, look, we'd like for you to come out and talk with us, but once you take a look at this book, we'll give you a call in a month or two, and you come to one of our meetings, and we have, some people, X amount of people, and they have questions, and we just want to make sure we have a sheriff that we can support, and we're just looking at you. Yeah. So however you want to say that kind of thing,
Yeah, okay. With
the Committee of Safety, it's a little more forceful, and if you follow the process that we wrote up. Now, I wouldn't say forceful, but it's something that it's going to draw him. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the paperwork that you put together, you want to come together and put all your paperwork together properly, and that should be impressive to him. Of course, you're giving him a book, you're giving him the paperwork, then he's going to come to a meeting a month or two later, and you're looking to see if we're going to support you.
Okay, but set up an appointment with him first,
I'll tell you, if you give the sheriff a book and 2 months later you go see him and he hasn't read it, I that's not a guy that I would support. I'd be looking for a different sheriff in the next election.
Yeah, because our sheriff in here in town is retiring, and, I think there's about 7 of them, trying to get in it, but I don't know any of them. So.
Well, they're running for office, and you should go get to know them because, again, that's the purpose of the Committee of Safety. You have X amount of people running for sheriff. You want to interview all of them, and they will come after the interview, especially the ones that aren't sheriffs yet because they're looking for support. And then you're going to discover who's willing to either, do that knows the right thing or willing to learn what the right thing is, and that's when you give them the copy of the books. I give them a hand of book. That's
yeah. Cool. But I know he does have the book, but I'll probably get some more for the other guys because I know one of them asked for it. So I'll probably give them some more.
Yeah, that's a good.
Thank you. Thank you, John. But I got one more question though. So, how do I reactivate my donation? Because Paul sent me an email and saying that was that I don't think. I think I need to update the cost. So do I go on your site and do that?
I'm not getting what you said. How do you reactivate what?
The membership. Donation.
Oh, well, if you want to change or cancel or whatever your donation.
Give in the right information because they change cars and...
All you have to do is under the blue bar to the right side, right under directory and members there, you'll see my account. You click on my account, and everything you can do concerning your membership, you can adjust there. If you're giving a donation, you click on that, and you can make your adjustments, change the amounts or whatever. By the way, we're going to be closing in a minute or two, but there was something I meant to bring up, and I forgot to bring it up earlier. We've been collecting money to go into the courts and file the sheriff's paper. The sheriff's paper has been filed. We're going through now serving, and we have one individual who put up the money to take care of that. So that's one thing. Since then, we've given some money. We've gotten two $500 donations, one $700 donation, one $100 donation, and two $20 donations. So Bill brought us to $1,840. That gives us enough to kind of do the filing and get things going, and pretty close. But we're still looking for
Hold on.
We're still looking for another $3,000 to upgrade the website. So look at the money we got so far has come from 6 people. 6 people have given us the $1,840, plus another person who gave us a couple of thousand plus to do the sheriff's paper. If everyone can just, even though we're given a membership, people who are members, if you're given a membership, $5 or $10 a month or whatever it is, that's really covering what we're doing on the site. We do need some money to get our website upgraded. So, if everybody were to give $5 or $10 or $20 extra bucks to throw it in and donate it, we can get it done. So we do need money. And we do need to upgrade our site. I am concerned that if we hit critical mass, there's some big things happening for us here in August, and we can't talk too much about it, but we will talk about it when the time comes. And it could give us the critical, we believe it's going to give us the critical mass. And if we hit the critical mass, we don't know how this website's going to handle that. And of course, that's also going to hit us with broadband and other costs that's going to escalate greatly and quickly, and we need to be able to support that. So again, everybody can give us a donation of $5 a month and a special donation, $5, $10, $20, or if you can afford more than that for the purpose of the court case and to upgrade the website. It's much needed. But with that, finish off, Ashula, and I got to move on because we've come 5 minutes past our program.
Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask you about what do you think about the state citizen, but that's okay. I can do that next week, no problem.
All right. Yeah, we'll talk next week. We'll be here. We're always
okay.
Here.
Okay.
We never miss.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to give Ken and the other person maybe 2 minutes apiece because we have to close down. We're past time. Is that Kim or Ken?
Kim. It's Kim. Hi, John. This is Kim. Can you hear me? It's spelled.
Yep.
It's spelled with an E instead of an I. Kim.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yes,
so
John.
So we can get into more conversation next week if you want, but we only got a minute or two.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I understand. I really do. I will definitely be back next week. And actually, my question was read out earlier by one of the hosts. It was actually a long, outdrawn question. It was actually emailed, and that one of your hosts read the question. It had to do with the garnishment and the bank that has
right.
been.
Why don't we talk about that next week? Give me a call. We'll get on a call next week. Try to get into the queue early as soon as it opens up, and we'll get you and we can discuss it more.
Okay.
We have one other person. I just want to give him a minute or two, and then we're going to close down. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kim. All right. The last caller is a 602 number. Looks like Sherwood or something. But what's your first name and your state?
John. Hello, John.
Yep. Go right ahead.
Yes. I have a situation that I dispute with the HOA been going on for 5 years, and they've been very unreasonable. But anyway, I had a lawyer one time, and he sent me up.
Yeah, your voice is familiar. What's your first name? We've spoken before.
Sandra, S-A-N-D-R-A, Sandra.
Okay. What state are you from?
And Arizona, Scottsdale, Arizona.
All right. But we can't right now because we're at the end of the program, but I'll try to spend a minute with you. What do you got?
Okay, I just make a quick question. I really do need the help, and I'm willing to help out your organization, and I need guidance that I will try coming up in September, but I've been waiting for the NYSARDA to go in effect. But it's been coming, but it's very slow, and I do watch Q movement very closely. So
yep.
Things are happening very fast, and yet NYSARDA is still, I mean, it looks like it's going to happen any day, and yet it's not. But meantime, I'm close to my trial, September 13th, and I haven't got a clue because my attorney was plain English. They were in bed together with the other side.
Yeah, lawyers sell you down the road constantly. It's a
that's
problem.
That's what he did. Yes, that's what he did.
Okay.
It cost me $238,000. And I don't
that's
even
great.
Have an estimate.
I'd like to talk to you about this because I think the people need to hear and understand, because I remember we had some conversation before concerning some of this stuff. Why don't you bring this up next Monday? Get into the queue early,
next Monday?
First ones, and we'll
okay.
look. Because I think your case could be an example for other people, and I might have some thoughts that can maybe be helpful. But the key,
I really hope so, and I will help you, and I want you to help me, and I am serious, and I'm very innocent victim. I have no idea. And
let's talk next week because we got to shut down right now. It's just way too late. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
And I've been beaten up a lot with emotionally. You see, that has caused a lot of damages emotionally between my lawyer and their lawyer and the evil. I mean, I learned a lot.
Let's talk next week and we'll get a fresh start on this thing because I think.
Thank you, John.
I think I can give you some thoughts and ideas on what you might want to do. Okay?
Okay. Thank you so much. Looking forward to next week. Appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
You too. All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming, and we'll see you next week. We'll be back. Good night, everybody.